All right, thanks. So I got to start with an apology, I think, because this talk is going to be on the cuprates, and I realize this is an iron-based session. So it's going to feel a little like a leftover from yesterday, but I hope that's okay. I think much of what I'm going to say might also be relevant in the iron-based superconductors. Thanks to the organizers for the invitation. So this is work recently done together with Doug Scalapino on trying to understand how pneumatic fluctuations near a pneumatic quantum critical point can lead to pairing or enhance the pairing interaction in the cuprates. So the outline is quite simple. I'm going to start by reviewing some of what has been said yesterday on charge and pneumatic order in the underdoped cuprates. Then I'm going to review some calculations by others on the three-band Hubbard model, trying to understand this pneumatic and charge order. And then I'm going to talk about what we have done recently on trying to understand how these pneumatic charge fluctuation can contribute to the pairing interaction in the cuprates. There's also a very similar study by Lederer and Kivelson and others, which appeared around the same time, which I'd just like to point out. The conclusions are rather similar. So you've seen this yesterday already. Of course, it's always been known that the spin degree of freedom in the cuprates plays a very important role. But more recently, there's also a lot of evidence that the charge degree of freedom might also be very important, at least in the underdoped whole-doped cuprates. There is now a lot of evidence from various probes for charge density waves in this region of the phase diagram, and the picture that seems to be emerging is that the charge order is static but short-ranged, and at the same time, this charge order is also accompanied by pneumatic order that lives inside the unit cell. That's from various other probes. There's evidence for this. This is a nice discussion of how one can reconcile these two different kinds of phenomena in terms of a density wave that has a D-wave form factor. So the particle-hole pairs that make up this density wave have an internal D-wave structure. And this seems to be quite consistent with recent STM measurements, which will be discussed, I think, later in the meeting again. Another result I like to point out is coming from quantum oscillation measurements by Ramshaw and collaborators, which recently appeared on archive. So they were able to suppress superconductivity over quite a range of hole doping. And so then they could measure the effective mass, and what they found is that this effective mass diverges as they approached a hole doping of about 0.18, which gives evidence for a quantum critical point right at this hole doping. And this is also the doping where the pseudogap line T star vanishes. It's also the hole doping where the highest TC is found. The second important result of this, I think, is that they find that the magnetic field that's needed to suppress superconductivity peaks right at this critical hole doping here. So that means superconductivity is really the strongest right at this hole doping, and it strongly implies that there are pseudogap quantum critical fluctuations that are involved in the pairing interaction. Okay, what about theory? Well, it's been pointed out already in 89 by Kivelson, Fradkin, and Emery that a pneumatic phase might be important in these systems, and they also pointed out the possible existence of a pneumatic quantum critical point just beyond optimal doping. More recently, Medlitsky and Sarstev studied how a pneumatic charge bond-ordered phase can emerge near a spin density wave instability. And then in a later calculation, they discussed how these pneumatic fluctuations can mediate an attractive pairing interaction. Okay, so we want to look at this from a microscopic starting point. So we're going to look at the three-band Hubbard model for a copper-oxygen plane. It's got the copper d orbitals in it, oxygen px and oxygen py orbitals, with energies epsilon d and epsilon p. They are separated by 2.5 electron volts in our case. Then there is hopping between the oxygens and the copper TPD, which we set to 1, so that's the unit of energy. Then there is direct hopping between the oxygens, TPP, which in our case is 0.5 electron volts. And then there is various interaction, of course, a very strong Coulomb interaction on the copper d orbitals, then a less strong Coulomb interaction on the oxygen orbitals. And then there are non-local Coulomb interactions between the copper and the oxygen, a VPD, and also a Coulomb interaction between the oxygens, VPP. And this is quite important, as you'll see, if you're interested in pneumatic fluctuations. The Fermi surface of this model looks like this for a doping of 0.15 holes, just as you would expect. Now, the RPA, of course, doesn't know about, or I'm sorry, so this is the Fermi surface for a non-interacting model. In that case, the Fermi energy is in the band that has mainly d character, so here are the orbital weights. Of course, if you add the Hubbard U, you split up the d band into a lower and an upper Hubbard band, then when you hold O, you're really in the p band, but in this case, we are in the d band. And there's also some oxygen orbital weights in this band. So this model has been studied quite extensively, first with respect to pneumatic correlations using a mean field approach by Fisher and Kim in 11. And they found that this model does have pneumatic instabilities. They found specifically intra-unit cell pneumatic order that is homogeneous, so it has Q equal to 0. I'm going to focus more on a recent study by Arno Kampf, which just appeared last year in PRB, who used an RPA, so a diagrammatic approach, to look at this. And so the quantity of interest is the pneumatic charge susceptibility, which is written down here. So the order parameter here is the difference of the charge on the oxygen X and the oxygen Y orbital. And so you get a minus sign for the cross terms XY here. So this is the pneumatic susceptibility. So what it indicates is a charge imbalance between the oxygen PX and the oxygen PY orbitals. And what is found in this model for example, these parameters, so you have to use a relatively large interaction between the oxygen P orbitals, is that you get a pneumatic instability, just like as was found previously in the mean field study, with Q equal to 0, so it's a homogeneous order. But it can also be modulated depending on the parameters. It can have finite Q, and the Q is along the diagonal. And so this is shown here, that if you, as a function of doping, you are below what's called a von Hove doping. This is where the von Hove singularity crosses the Fermi energy. You get a diagonal order, and the Q vector increases as you move away from this von Hove doping. On the other side of it, you get essentially Q equal to 0 order. And here is a phase diagram for these parameters. So inside here, we have pneumatic order. There's a pneumatic quantum critical point at around 0.19. On this side of the phase diagram, the order has Q equal to 0. On this side, it's diagonal in Q. So then the question we were interested in is, if you have these pneumatic fluctuations, how can they give rise to pairing? Or what kind of pairing interaction is associated with these pneumatic fluctuations? And so in order to look at this, we use, again, an RPA approach. The pairing interaction is given by these terms, by these types of diagrams. You can resum them. For this case, it's a little bit more complicated because you're dealing with interactions which are non-local, but you can read about it in these papers. We essentially use this formalism to deal with it. And again, in the end, you end up with a pairing interaction when you resum these terms that has a charge part and a spin part. So there is the local Coulomb repulsion in these two terms here. The charge interaction comes in with a minus sign, and here is the spin interaction with a plus sign. So this one is repulsive in the spin channel. In the charge channel, the fluctuation term here is actually attractive. OK, so now let's, for the moment, just forget about the charge part of this interaction. Then, of course, we know what to expect. We know quite well that in that case, the interaction is given by the spin part of the interaction. The spin susceptibility for this type of system is peaked at large momentum transfer and near pi pi. So in the pairing interaction, you want to scatter pairs that are living on these spots of the Fermi surface to these spots because you have this large momentum transfer. You put a positive gap here in the gap equation because of the minus sign here, and the fact that this interaction is, of course, repulsive in momentum space. You then want to have a negative sign of the gap in this region, and that's what leads to a dx squared minus y squared type gap if you just have spin fluctuations. So now let's look at what we would expect if we only had charge fluctuations. So I've shown you in this model, you have something that's peaked near q equals 0. It's either exactly at q equals 0 or small q. So now the interaction is just given, let's just consider an interaction that's just given by the charge part of the interaction. So now we have a minus sign here. It's attractive, and it's peaked at small q. So now if we have a d-wave order already from the spin fluctuation, this interaction can actually cooperate because it scatters pairs on these parts of the Fermi surface where the gap has the same sign. So it gives you an attractive interaction at small momentum transfer, which can also be accommodated by this d-wave type gap structure. So the idea is that near this quantum critical point, you have, in addition to the spin fluctuation, you would have charge fluctuations, which can then enhance the pairing near this point and, for example, give you higher TC. So let's look at the calculation. So for the moment, again, we just consider an interaction that's given by the charge fluctuations. So we completely ignore the spin fluctuation of the interaction. I'm going to add it back in later. But for the moment, it's just the charge interaction. Then we're going to solve the linearized gap equation, which has this form. We look at the leading eigenvalues and eigenvectors of this Bethe-Zipeda equation. And of course, the pairing interaction is initially calculated in orbital space. But then we are interested in the pairing of electrons, of Bloch electrons, so we have to transform this to the band space, which enters then in this gap equation. And the parameters we are going to be using for this study is a U on the copper D of 9, a U on the oxygen P of 3 electron volts, VPD is 1, VPP is 2. That's just the parameters we saw before in this study of the pneumatic fluctuations. Okay, so now here is how things look like. So again, the pairing interaction is just given by the charge part of the interaction. Plotted here is the pneumatic charge susceptibility. As you can see, it's peaked at right at q equal to 0. So in terms of this phase diagram, we are located right here, so above this pneumatic phase and in a region where the pneumatic fluctuations have q equal to 0. Now, if you put that into the pairing interaction, you get something like this. So negative means, blue means negative, red means positive. I fixed the second momentum to be right here, and then it's plotted as a function of the first momentum. So we scatter pairs from this momentum to the other momentums. And so you see for small momentum transfer, so in this region, and this, of course, is also small momentum transfer because it's just an umklapp. The pairing is attractive because of this charge interaction. As you go to larger momentum transfer, it becomes repulsive. That's because you still have this constant U term, so to speak, which, of course, is repulsive. And so you get something like this. Now you can ask, what kind of gap does this support? Essentially, any kind of gap, because it's really quite local in K, but the leading gap structure that you get from pairing interaction like this is a d-wave. It looks like this. It has a pairing strength of 1.87 for these particular parameters. But nearby is an S wave, and it's actually an extended S wave. It changes sign. It has modes right here. It goes from positive to negative in this region. And it has almost the same pairing strength. So this tells us that the pneumatic pairing interaction that you get from this is attractive in the D wave and also in the extended S wave channels. We can also look at a different part of the phase diagram. So now we're going to move over here a little. In this region, we have pneumatic fluctuations that are peaked now at finite Q, so diagonal, along the diagonal. So the pneumatic charge susceptibility looks like this. It gives you a pairing interaction that looks very similar. It's just that now you have, you can see this a little bit, the maximum is not right for at K equal to K zero, but it's slightly shifted along the diagonal. The maximum is right here, but otherwise it looks very similar. It again is attractive for small momentum transfer, repulsive for larger momentum transfer. And again, this pairing interaction for this case is also attractive in the D wave channel, and it's also attractive in the extended S wave channel. The pairing strength is slightly smaller than before. It's because we are farther away from the pneumatic instability. You can also compare the detailed momentum dependence of the gap. So this is plotting the gap around the Fermi surface. The D wave looks exactly like the D wave in the case where the pneumatic fluctuations have Q equal to zero. The S wave is also very similar. The minima are just slightly deeper in the diagonal case. Okay, now we can try to understand what happens on this side of the phase diagram as we approach the pneumatic quantum critical point. And so we're going to move from the right towards this instability here. And again, on this side of the phase diagram, the pneumatic fluctuations have Q equal to zero. Plotted here on the left is this Q equal to zero peak in the pneumatic susceptibility as a function of doping. So it diverges as we go towards the quantum critical doping right here. Plotted on the right is the pairing strength for the S wave and also for the D wave. And you can see they're essentially degenerate as we move towards the quantum critical point. And again, you see they increase quite rapidly simply because the pairing interaction you get out of this attractive pneumatic fluctuations increases also. So the pairing strength increases as the pneumatic quantum critical point is approached. It's second order, but I believe you might want to ask Arnold Kampf, who is also here, who has looked at that in more detail. All right. So now here, I'm again looking at this question, what happens as we move towards the quantum critical point? In particular, I'm going to look at the question, what happens to the momentum structure of the gap? So here we are farther away. This is a doping of 0.22. The susceptibility looks like this. Again, peak at Q equals zero. It's relatively broad. Here is the gap structure. The blue line is the D wave. It's compared to a cosine kx minus cosine ky. You can see it's relatively close to a dx squared minus y squared, although there are some deviations here. In red is the extended S wave. But let's just focus on the D wave for now. As we move closer to the quantum critical point, the pneumatic fluctuations sharpen up, of course. They become stronger, more narrow in Q space. As a result of that, the D wave now looks like this. So it's quite different from the cosine kx minus cosine ky. That just means that we have higher D wave harmonics in this structure. In other words, it reflects a long-arranged interaction for this case. So it's exactly what one would expect. Similar things happen for the extended S wave, of course. Now, as I've told you before, in our case, we are living in the D band, but the pneumatic fluctuations happen on the oxygen. So you need to couple the D band to the pneumatic fluctuations on the oxygen. And this coupling, of course, is given by the Coulomb interaction between P and D. So then you can study what happens to the pairing strength, for example, as you tune the VPD. So what I'm allowing here is that the coupling to the charge fluctuations here, V bar, is actually different from the term we have here. And I'm going to adjust the VPD in this term, which is this axis, and look at what the pairing strength does. And as you can see, as we turn up VPD, the pairing strength for both D wave and S wave rises. So again, that's just simply because we are in the D band. The orbital character of this band is mainly given by the D orbitals. We need to couple to the pneumatic fluctuations on the oxygens. And so that's why we get a result like this. Of course, in reality, if you know about the Mott gap, you're living in the P band, mainly P band. And so then VPT plays less of a role than the coupling is already mainly given by VPP. One can also look at whether there's a way of making the extended S wave actually the winning gap structure. And obviously, you can imagine that this can be done by decreasing or reducing this constant term here, the constant interaction, which is repulsive. And that's what I'm doing here. So I'm putting a factor alpha in front of this term, not in front of this term, and then look at the pairing strength as a function of this parameter. The D wave really doesn't care much about this. And that's obviously, as you would expect, the D wave doesn't really have a local contribution, so it doesn't care about this term. There's a little bit of dependence here. That's just simply because the way I've written this is somewhat misleading. This term, of course, has some momentum dependence because it has non-local interaction terms in it. But the D wave doesn't really care about this term much. On the other hand, the extended S wave, of course, does. And you can see as you reduce the alpha, the extended S wave pairing strength goes up, crosses the D wave, and then becomes the leading gap structure if you're able to reduce this local Coulomb repulsion quite a bit. And the corresponding gap structures for the extended S wave are plotted here. You can see for large alpha, you have nodes. It goes from positive to negative. Then these minima go up as you reduce alpha, and eventually it becomes nodeless. So it's an S wave without nodes when this local contribution is quite small. So as I said, so far I've only considered what happens if we completely ignore the spin fluctuations in this calculation. They're, of course, there. The problem is for the parameters we put in, you already have an SDW instability. So in order to look at this question, you know, who is the main player, the charge or the spin, you have to allow for different parameters in the charge and in the spin channel. So I'm going to allow for a difference in these parameters. For the charge channel, I'm going to use the same parameters as before. For the spin channel, I have to use much smaller parameters. That's an artifact of the RPA, really. And then also, this is somewhat of an ill-posed question, of course, because obviously the result you're going to get for this depends on whether you're closer to the SDW phase, whether you're closer to the pneumatic phase. So the way I'm going to deal with that is I'm going to go to a spot in the phase diagram where the charge susceptibility has the same magnitude as the spin susceptibility. And I'm also going to allow, again, for a different coupling here to the a different coupling than what I have here. But this coupling is going to be chosen the same as the coupling to the spin fluctuations. So equal rights for everybody, basically. Yeah. And so here are the parameters. I'm going to be here in the phase diagram. For the charge parameters. I'm going to use just what I've had before. I get this pneumatic susceptibility here in the charge channel. It has a magnitude of about 1, is peak at Q equal to 0. The spin susceptibility is plotted here, and so as I said, we have to go to much smaller interaction parameters so that this thing doesn't diverge. The parameters are given here. Again, the maximum is at around pi pi, and the magnitude is around 1, the same as in the charge channel. For these couplings, I'm going to use these parameters, and again, they are the same in the spin and in the charge channel. And then when I do this, I can look at the pairing strength. If I just include the charge interaction, you get a lambda that's about 0.76. On the other hand, if you just include the spin interaction, you get a lambda of 16. So in other words, the spin fluctuations for this particular case still play the dominant role in the interaction. And you get some enhancement, obviously, from the charge interaction. But the main player certainly comes from the spin. Now, of course, this is a very phenomenological study, but I don't know how to do it otherwise for an RPA calculation like this. Yeah, I'm basically done. So let me go through the conclusions. I've shown you that if you have pneumatic fluctuations in the system, this gives you an attractive pairing interaction. And usually these pneumatic fluctuations are peaked at small momentum transfer, so the pairing interaction is also peaked at small momentum transfer. Again, it's attractive because it enters with a minus sign in the charge channel. And so an interaction like this can give rise to pairing in all kinds of channel, but in particular it's attractive in the D-wave channel. It's also, as you've seen, attractive in the S-wave channel. And it increases, the strength of it increases as the pneumatic quantum critical point is approached. So because it's attractive in the D-wave channel, it can cooperate also with the spin fluctuation interaction, which has a nature, of course, that's very different. It's repulsive at large momentum transfer, but it can cooperate with this so that both the spin and the charge channel can contribute to the D-wave pairing strength. All right. Thanks.
I have plenty of time. Thomas, I have twofold question. So part one is that the existence of the quantum critical point, was that just an accident? You tuned the parameters that it happens to be at 0.18, similar to experiments?
Absolutely. And again, Arno Kampf can tell you more about that. But you choose different parameters. It happens to be at a different point.
Right. And the second question, and that's more relevant to the aryanictites. So the first part of your conclusion is that pneumatic fluctuations seem to be attractive at small momentum transfer. So then if I were naively to apply this picture to the nictites, am I right in saying that provided the pockets are not too big. Let's say on electron pockets, you will have some attractive pairing similar on hole. That doesn't really tell you whether it's plus minus or S plus plus, right? Because it only dictates what happens locally, locally in K space.
So absolutely, it's the same in the nictides. If it's peaked at small momentum transfer, that takes you within the same hole pocket or within the same electron pocket, you would expect very similar results. It would enhance the pairing.
Oh, yeah. I have actually three questions, all kind of technical perhaps. The first one is, when you worry about charge, you have to worry about long-range Coulomb interaction, right? So you know that the charge fluctuations in the LS0 channel give rise to a plasmon. Mm-hmm. And plasmon-mediated pairing is a long history. It's a snake pit. You want to stay away from it. I would have expected that you would have sort of done an angular momentum decomposition where you say that the pneumatic fluctuations are LS2, right? It's Pomeranchuk. It's driven by an F2 parameter when you do the Fermi-liquid CU. I guess you do it effectively, right? And why do you ignore the long-range Coulomb interaction? You're not allowed to do that when you look at charge and you incorporate your LS0 channel
as
well. Yeah,
of course we ignore it here, but so...
Any difference? My good feeling is not, right? Because you really learn the LS2 in all this. Yeah. It's quite a polar fluctuation, LS2, right? Pomeranchuk.
Yeah.
The second question is very simple. Once upon a time, I wrote a thesis where this whole business was called charge transfer insulators, as one very important parameter, the charge transfer energy. Mm-hmm. What do you pick for charge transfer energy?
It's 2.5
electron. Standard value, yeah. The third one is, to the best of my understanding, an experiment, right? It's like Soubirous D-wave, D-density wave. The pneumatic order goes hand in hand with also translational symmetry breaking. Mm-hmm. What would be the role of that in this whole story?
Well, so it depends on where you are in the phase diagram. Let's see. Sorry. Okay. So if you're on the right side here, where you have the black part of the phase diagram, there's no translational symmetry breaking. It's Q equals zero. And so you get a result like this. On the left side, you do have translational symmetry breaking. You have finite Q. You get a very similar result, as I've shown. It's also attractive in the D-wave channel, and so on. It's very similar. I think what's important for this is just that the Q is small. It's peaked at small Q. I'm not sure about that. Okay. All right. It might be very similar.
I just had a question about the phase diagram of this model. So you've shown that there's a pneumatic phase, and then there's a charge density wave phase nearby. Where's the spin density wave pictured on this phase diagram?
It's just being ignored. Okay. For the parameters for which you get this phase diagram, you already have a spin density wave instability.
Okay, so it's all that dome stuff is below a spin density wave transition?
Exactly. You just have to ignore it in the RPA type treatment.
I have two questions. The first one is, it seems that you started with a pneumatic interaction, which breaks C4, yet the gap structure you got is fully C4 rotationally invariant. I was just wondering at which step this X and Y bias is lost.
Well, you're not really breaking C4. It's fluctuating, right?
You consider the fluctuation in both directions.
Yeah.
Yeah, correct. Okay. My second question is, I'm very interested in that 16 versus 0.79 story. Seems that you started from this of same order interaction strengths. Can you give us some sense what is happening, what is causing this huge difference?
It's a good question. I'm not sure I completely understand it yet, to be honest. This is what you're referring to. I don't know if I have a good answer, to be honest. It's just that somehow this interaction is much more effective in driving a D-wave than this interaction. Because obviously we used the same coupling parameters for this. The susceptibilities have about the same strength.
What is the lambda?
The difference between 16 and 0.76 is not very much.
I know. Once you get into that business, I'd be more comfortable, I think. So of course that's completely ignored, and
Well, my question is exactly in the same direction, so to understand these really very different numbers and where
Absolutely.
Do you get that from? I mean, whether you have some physical intuition for these differences, but okay.
It's a good question, but unfortunately not.
More questions? Let me ask a naive one at the end. This is about just understanding how to get Z-Wave out of purely charge channel.
Mm-hmm.
So your interaction is attractive, peaked at Q equal to zero.
Mm-hmm.
Why at the end you go to larger momentum transfer, interaction remains attractive, you don't change sign of chi?
No, it does not remain attractive.
Change of sign of chi of Q?
No. Chi of Q is, of course, always
but
positive.
Then,
but where do I have it? Here is an example, right? So so you are asking why it changes from attractive to repulsive?
No, I'm asking this. You have interaction, V squared times chi.
Yeah.
Which is supposed to be, as you said, attractive at small q.
Yes.
And it's also attractive at large q because it doesn't change sign.
No. It changes sign. The pairing interaction changes sign right here. It goes from negative blue to positive red.
How it comes if it's D wave and a constant term doesn't matter?
No, this is not projected onto D wave at all.
Oh, okay.
This is just without any projection.
For D
wave, if you project it onto the D wave channel, then it's attractive. Everywhere.
The system gives a solution when the gap
this is the yes. This is without projection onto any challenge, so it just changes sign because of this constant U-term.
This is just related to this question. If you can put by hand this VC to be zero and look at just, do we still get a D wave in that case?
Yes, and I've gone to that limit, not quite, but let's see. In this plot, where I put a factor of alpha in front of it, and so yes, the D wave really doesn't care about this constant term much. So the D wave lambda doesn't change, but the S wave does care. So you still get the D wave, but in that case, the S wave is much larger strength.
So to which extent is this, could this be in any way useful on a quantitative level? So basically you're showing that the pneumatic, well, you get trends that might be interesting, but then it's completely, in these calculations that we all do, it's completely overwhelmed by the magnetic instability.
Yeah, absolutely.
So could you comment on this? Because they seem to be dominant in the phase diagram, experimentally seems to show much larger pneumatic content than we would ever get from these kind of itinerant pictures.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm not sure how much more I can comment on that. Obviously, what I want to do next is a quantum Monte Carlo study of this, and then I can answer your question. But the hope, of course, is that in that case, all these interaction parameters, of course, are renormalized, and the hope is they're going to be renormalized in a way that you get, you know, similar contributions from both.
So what's the relation between the charge and the spin pneumaticity in your model?
This is just purely from charge. The spin is
completely
left out of, it's ignored, yeah.
Yeah, so then I want to make a comment. I'm not sure how constructive it is. I think this is a, I want to be honest. I think this is, this is a good exercise to understand the role of pneumatic fluctuations in driving various instabilities. Now, in the cuprates, the pneumatic state is actually a melted stripe. And it has low energy fluctuations, which are seen in elastic neutron scattering, for instance, that look like stripes on scales small compared to the superconducting gap.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very far from this Pomeranchuk limit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It would be interesting here, for example, also to look at frequency dependence and so on.
Thank you. Have you considered adding in, restoring forces for nematicity like you have in the 214 compounds, where you have this instability towards tilting and rotation of the octahedra with very small energy differences between the different phases?
Mm-hmm.
And have you looked at the effect of those on the transition?
No, we have not, but I think that would be interesting to do, yeah.
You mentioned briefly that the Fermi surface may play, or the Van Hove singularity plays a role. So I mean, which exactly is the, what exactly is the role of the Fermi surface shape, or is it hole-like, electron-like? Does it switch at the quantum critical point, or?
No, it doesn't switch at the quantum critical point. It switches at what we call Van Hove doping. And right at this point, the pneumatic fluctuations switch from having a finite Q to a Q equal to zero. So that's the role of this change.
So then at optimal doping, you still have a finite Q?
That depends on all your parameters you put in, right? But yes,
theoretically, this
you know, it, if you assume that the Fermi surface still is hole-like at optimal doping, close around the endpoint, then you would, within this theory, still get a finite Q. Yeah.
Okay. More questions? If not, thanks again. And move to new talk. Takashi Bayuchi, University of Tokyo. This one was about nictites. Quantum criticality and BCSBC crossover in iron-based supercomputing.